This is Carl Lipkin, Visual Arts and the Search for Meaning, September 24th, 1993.
Creativity and transformation. This evening is the beginning of a series, The Arts Revealing the Psyche, beginning with Carl Lipkin. Friday, 24th of September, Visual Arts and the Search for Meaning, a lecture and slide presentation by Carl Lipkin. The arts have served as carriers and interpreters of myths, mystery, and the cultural histories for tens of thousands of years. In this age of science and psychology, our relationship to the arts is shifting dramatically. We will consider these shifts while viewing slides from a range of periods and cultures, including African, Asian, European, North American traditions. We will also explore the thoughts of a number of distinguished artists and scholars. Questions and discussions following.
We join Dr. Gordon Keating in the midst of his opening remarks and introduction.
And the idea here is that we wanted to have people to be able to come and talk about their own art creations or the art creations of other people, and that we could find out about the psyche in that way. And that's a little different way of going at it, perhaps, than the more intellectual way or something that might be from, you know, hearing more about Jung's ideas or hearing from people who have studied Jung and Jungian analysts and so on. I mean, that's good, but obviously the psyche is very large, and the arts are perhaps one of the most powerful expressions for psyche that has been around for thousands of years, way before Jung, of course. So I'm really pleased that we're having this series and that Carl is actually the person who's the first person in the series. We have some other programs coming up in the future. In his background, he has a master's in counseling from Antioch with he specialized in art therapy. And he really also is an artist. He apprenticed with his father in sculpture. He's worked in jewelry. He's worked in art installation. And then he had a long period of time, I don't know how long that was, but where he was a merchant seaman. He was off on the seas around the world. And now he's settled here in Seattle, and he's begun his practice.
I really am honored that people would take the time and spend the money to come and hear a talk and hear me talk on art. And it's very exciting for me. It represents my first public coming out as someone who knows about art, aside from working with hands-on. So it's very exciting for me, and because of the delays, I've had a whole year in which to obsess about it. And as a result, you see, I have hundreds of quotes here, of which I'll start at page 10, so it's not so... No, but so what I want to do, I've put together slides that I hope you'll find exciting. But first I want to talk a little bit from the intellectual side, because when people come to a lecture, many different people want many different kinds of things, and I'm very excited about ideas. But of course, I'm going to have to make it relatively short, so it's a great condensation. But maybe in the question and answer period, you know, we can touch on some of these other things. What happened in the course of my inquiry into the question of meaning, and before I realized how absurdly audacious I was, you know, about 3 months ago, I all of a sudden was struck by, oh my God. I'm going to purport to talk about meaning. But as I entered it, it seemed to me that it was essential to go into philosophy, that there was no way to approach meaning without philosophy. And as I entered philosophy, I got to memory, that there was no way to be in philosophy without history. And there was no way to be into those without language. And then image. And so all of these things, you know, had to be respected. And fortunately, there's a
a wonderful wealth of information, and Jung was very keen on all of this. And so there are many, many wonderful people. So I'm going to just talk, I'm very into quoting, too. I started collecting quotes, and then I found that the more I collected them, the more I loved them. And then I came upon Walter Benjamin. Some of you may know, he was a tremendous critic and essayist who died, unfortunately, in 1940, but he was arguably the most brilliant social critic of his time in Germany, a good friend of Brecht. And one of the things that he did was he collected quotations. I discovered this late in my researches and was thrilled that he collected quotations and regarded them as the essential way to make sense of the current era, given its chaos. So he mined literature for quotations and said that the past could be preserved primarily because the quotations could be torn out of the present, and therefore condensed it. So it has that benefit, that it's a distillation, although, of course, every quotation, I'm very fond of saying, every quotation is out of context, but still we need them. And particularly the brilliant people who've taken part in this conversation before us. So I want to start on the philosophical side and read you a little bit of Heidegger, who was incredible on language. So he's quoting Novalis, who was this young rising star. Many of you know him. He didn't live very long, but he was incredibly brilliant. And so here's Heidegger. University philosophers will never understand what Novalis said. Philosophy, and for Heidegger, all philosophy is metaphysics, is strictly speaking a homesickness. It is not a discipline that can be learned. The sciences are only servants in relation to it. But art and religion are its sisters. He who does not know what homesickness is cannot philosophize. It is only possible for us to philosophize if and because we do not feel at home anywhere, because we are unceasingly being pushed up against being, against that in being which is total and essential. Because we feel at home nowhere except on the way to the total and essential. Fantastic. We are without a native land and are restlessness itself. And this is poetry, isn't it? I shouldn't interrupt him. Sorry, Heidegger. It is because of this that it is necessary for us to philosophize. And this restlessness is our confinement. In us, who are finitude itself, we are not allowed to let it pass away, to comfort ourselves in an illusion about totality and satisfactory infinitude. We must not only bear this restlessness, but accentuate it. And when we are not only confined, but entirely isolated, only then do we strive more to incite ourselves to be important, civilized. Only then are we in a position to be gripped and thus make ourselves grippable by handing ourselves over to reality. Our homesickness makes us into human beings. You might think I'm going crazy here, but I'm going to continue with Heidegger, but only one brief sentence. Because whenever we get into language and start discussing art, I find interpretation immediately comes up. You know, if we're going to put something on the screen, it's already an interpretation. It's been decided that it's worthy for whatever reason. So, hermeneutics, is the descendant of the Greek word for interpretation. I mean, that's our definition is interpretation. And of course, it comes from Hermes, I wish I had time to go into Hermes, but so here's Heidegger again. The expression hermeneutic derives from the Greek word hermeneuon. Forgive my pronunciation. That verb is related to the noun hermeneus. Anyway, I'm going to skip a little bit. Anyway, Hermes is the divine messenger. He brings the message of destiny. Hermeneuon is that exposition which brings tidings. because it can listen to a message. So an interpretation is listening to a message, not bringing a judgment, but listening to a message, which I think is really beautiful. So there we go with Heidegger. And we'll go to Hillman. Hillman, incidentally, represents the largest of my categories. I just find that he delves into Jung so deeply and brings in archetypal psychology so deeply, which, you know, is kind of, to me, not to presume that I understand Jung, but it's today, you know? It's today's version, this incredibly piercing mind that Hillman is. So anyway, this is still on the subject of philosophizing. So here Hillman says, one can still share in the perspectives of religion, science, and humanism, but one need not assume their premises or come to their conclusions. It is possible to personify and imagine about divine persons without being a theologian, to pathologize and examine symptoms without being a medical scientist, and to psychologize about language and images, the history of ideas, and method of knowledge without being a humanist or a philosopher. But if forced into an alliance with any of the three, and this is the key, then archetypal psychology is close to the service and study of gods as it is to the service and study of man. So here, one of the most brilliant psychologists living gives us permission to philosophize, theologize. And I found it tremendously freeing, you know. And to accent the idea that this is a divine project that we're about. And this, of course, we're going to get to much more always again and again as we look into the greatest of art. It's connected somehow with the divine. Not necessarily in the theological, churchly way, but the divine aspirations. I'm going to read a few more quotes, and then we're going to rather finish with the cerebral side to this extent. And the other thing I wanted to say, I had planned to say, is that without hoping I don't sound presumptuous, for those of you who are not into this kind of thinking very much, I just hope you'll feel free to just let it breathe by you and not be offended by it or not judge yourselves because you're not familiar with the ground of it or any of that. And forgive me, too, if it seems like this isn't what I came for. Because I think that over and over, when you read some of these great minds, of course they were great thinkers, they stress the importance of clarity in language and clarity of ideas, that how important, and obviously none of you would have come here if you didn't believe that, really. Okay, so to move on. Now here's Agnella Jaffe, who was very close to Jung and wrote some books about him and things of that sort. Now, of course, meaning is right in the topic here, so I just want to say a little bit about meaning as far as Jung goes. So here's Jaffe talking about Jung. She said, the meaning of life for Jung is the realization of the self. And here she quotes Jung, all life is bound to individual carriers who realize it. But every carrier is charged with an individual destiny. And destination, which is the self. And the realization of these alone makes sense of life. The archetype of the self, he says, is nameless and ineffable. The individuation process culminates not in the fullest possible life lived for its own sake, and not in a profounder intellectual understanding, the meaning flows from the numinosity of the self. And now, here's a brief statement by Jung on what constitutes the self. The self is our life's goal, for it is the completest expression of that fateful combination we call individuality. I just want to read one more quote on memory. I'll just sort of summarize what I would have read. Benjamin was very into Baudelaire, the French, you know, with those great caves and this ancient contact with Europe. You know, they have this tremendous sense of memory. Proust, you know, writing the remembrances of things past, and Baudelaire, hearkening back to the ancient past. And this rings a great chord with me because I've always been drawn to the past since my childhood. I've had very strong feelings about prehistory and feeling that our notion of how old human beings were was greatly underestimated. I just felt it. And so it's very, very nice for me to read these great thinkers and poets talking also about that. And I'll just read a little poem, just a couple stanzas from Baudelaire on this, which is not the greatest translation, but, and then, so anyway, he says, "Man wends his way through forests of symbols, which look at him with their familiar glances, as long resounding echoes from afar, are mingling in a deep dark unity, vast as the night or as the orb of day. Perfumes, colors, and sounds commingle." Just a word from Ralph Ellison. I want to get some Americans in here. Ralph Ellison said, "That which we remember is more often than not that which we would like to have been or that which we hope to be. Thus, our memory and our identity are ever at odds. Our history, ever a tale told by inattentive idealists." It was beautiful. Okay, so now we're going to go to the slides. And for me, to try to encapsulate it a little bit, unless we're connected with history in a very deep way, then this homesickness is almost incurable. You know? I mean, everyone knows about this. The Native Americans are always talking about walking on the earth which contains the bones of the ancestors, and that's what makes it holy. But we're very, where are our ancestors' bones? Most of us don't even know. And so I just think it's critical. It's only one important aspect, but it's just one that I've paid a lot of attention to. So, let's look at some pictures. Oh, there's something I forgot to do, too. And that is I forgot two things. I forgot to thank everybody who helped me so much. My friends have been just incredible. Hours and hours of help and encouragement, you know, for my debut. And just tremendous help. Tremendous help. And I also want to thank the Jung Society for giving me a chance to participate in something worthwhile to the community and encouraging me to step out. So I really am grateful for that. And the other, the public library has just been incredible. I mean, you can call them up with a esoteric question and they'll go to work and research it for you and call you up, and it's phenomenal. They're just beautiful people. And I guess I want to thank, too, my parents. who put me on the road to art as a little child. I keep promising to start, don't I? Oh, there's one more quote. But you're going to get an image to go with it. So this, as, let's see, how is it for focus and all that? Is there somebody with a good eye for focus? It's what? Yeah. Could somebody play with it up there? You can't read it. You better go back to the U and take a couple years of Latin, I guess. It may be, oh, much better, yeah. Good, thank you. So this is from Jung's Red Book, and this is his fantasy figure, Philemon. He spent 6 years in this deep inner quest. Do I? Oh, wow. High technology. Thank you. Let's see. Is that good? Okay, so at the end of those 6 years, he recorded these things. And so this is the wise figure out of his unconscious that has more wisdom than he. And it really shows what an incredible life of the mind Jung had, and how he lived in so many different ages. You know, I mean, here he is authentically placed in these early manuscript thinking with total control of the language and the imagery. It's pretty fantastic. And so this is this incredible quote from Jung. He who takes the sure path is already dead. Isn't that beautiful? And so that's what inspired me not to write any notes for this, just to bring 500 or 600 pages of quotes. And there's another great one. I just can't resist this one. This is Socrates. When a man aspires for wisdom, he is already practicing dying. When a man aspires for wisdom, he is already practicing dying. So now we're getting ready to go way back in time. I'd like to invite you to prepare to drop back through the centuries, through millennia, through deep time, because that's where we're going to try to go. Let me see if I can focus this guy. Yeah, all right. Let's just have a quiet minute with this man. We're talking 1.5 million years to 300,000 years ago. These are our ancestors then. Powerful. See, we live in this linear time where we, in the 18th century, people imagined that the beginning of the creation was about 4000 BC, or something like that. Well, people were painting things 300,000 years ago. And this guy here, he was a sophisticated, relatively sophisticated toolmaker, among other things. So let's move on. So here's Richard Leakey, one of the great, I'm sure most of you know him, one of the great, oh, I don't know, ethnoarchaeologists, I don't know what, he's a paleontologist, he's a many, many, many things. Self-educated, of course he comes from the famous His mother and father were world-renowned. He's a tremendous human being. And I highly recommend his books. Now, the tools on his desk are 1.5 million years old. 1.5 million. So I think it's one thing for us to have this information intellectually and say, okay, 1.1 million, 1.3 million, but to try to feel it. You know, usually we get to about the Egyptians and then we think everybody's sort of stumbling around before that. But these are our ancestors, and they still exist in us. The collective unconscious is this memoria of Augustine. I mean, this is all connected right to this. 2.5 million years we've been on our feet and doing things with intention. Okay, so now here we come to 100,000 years, where the technology is stepping up. The stone on the left was in use between 100,000 and 40,000 years ago. And instead of lugging stones around, people flaked off pieces. You can see that there's intentional flakes off this core. And at the break, I have one of these up here. You can come and handle one. I was very lucky to get one up in Canada, though it's from Africa. So these are very beautiful things. So these are, there's artistry in these because they didn't necessarily have to be that beautiful to do the job, but people were already aesthetic, very aesthetic, 100,000 years ago. Beauty meant a lot. Now here we come to 32,000 years ago. This little ivory figure from Vogelherd, Germany, of a mammoth. So here's already complex symbols. I mean, they seem simple X's, but there's more going on than we know. Wonderful little thing. Beautiful. See, the other thing, usually I promise myself not to be critical, but one of the problems that we have as a culture with art is that usually we're exposed to it either in galleries or the homes of friends or museums. And when we hear about it, it's usually from professors or people, professionals in the art world. And they generally, unless we're hearing directly from artists, they generally have a stake in a point of view. So that if I'm an art expert and I'm going to present this to you, it's not enough for me to come up and say, now, isn't that beautiful? My God, isn't that beautiful? No, I mean, because why would I be paid for that? You could say the same thing yourself. Gee, that's beautiful. We don't know what it means. Gosh, how about 45, 65,000 a year for that? But not only just cynically, but because we love ideas, and because when, you know, the brain research has shown us, to some extent, the split brain research that's been done on people with epilepsy in the last 20 years, shown that on the left side of the brain, there's an interpreting mechanism which just goes to work right away. So if you separate the two parts of the brain and you show a picture of an apple on one side and a snowstorm on the other, and you ask people to match them up from different sides of the brain, when you get to the left side of the brain, it makes up reasons. Well, the reason I brought this snow shovel was because I had to, you know, shovel chicken manure. It's just, there are just reasons pouring out of the left brain. And so once we start feeding that left brain information, it just runs with it. So as soon as we start down the road of dates and descriptions and comparisons, then the heart feeling side, the capacity for being penetrated deeply through the whole of us, is reduced. And that's the place that we need to bring to art. That's where 95% of it takes place, is in the wholeness. And so what we want to do with this is allow it to penetrate deeply into us, to open as much as possible, and be silently reverential toward it. That's the way we get the message of history. No book No explanation, no date, no writing can ever approach the opening of the whole of the self to the object. That's the key, and that's the most forgotten thing. 30,000 years. Now we have inscrutable symbols, which Leakey tells us these occur widely throughout Europe and Africa. And Leakey concludes from this that surely sophisticated language was present 30,000 years, you know, and probably longer. They're wonderful, intuitive little beings or whatever. And now, of course, we're at Lascaux, the Great Caves, the Ice Age, Upper Paleolithic. Of course, I'm talking not to give dates, and here I'm dating my brains out, but we all love it, you know. Everybody wants to know when. Also just exquisite. So the other important thing to know about these things, I believe, is that it's good for us to let go our tendency that we've been educated to think that they're somewhat simplistic. You know, beautiful and charming, and isn't it wonderful that they could draw? But this is far more than that. You know, these people, now 40,000 years ago, our biological systems were fully in place. Fully in place. Somebody in the collective unconscious. So these people were genetically identical to us, you know? So there's no reason to, I mean, they just had a different way of symbologizing. So that's very useful for us to remember. Look at that, same period. Now what you're looking at is a small detail, and the black line going up is the leg of an animal. I showed the detail because I think it's a phenomenal piece of just pure abstract art. I mean, this is obviously, look at these people. They were with profound grace and symmetry and into all the structures of the universe. And this is this phenomenal sense of color to have lasted, you know, 12, 15,000 years and still beautiful. Chumash Indians, our side of the water. 1,000 years ago, maybe up to 1,700, somewhere in there. That's a little out of focus in there. Now, some more words I can't resist. This is going to be fun. Let's see. You all know Camille Paglia? The Birth of the Western Eye. I'm just going to read little bits here and there. The Latin mater and materia, mother and matter, are etymologically connected. Venus of Willendorf, that's her up there, is the nature mother as primeval muck, oozing into infant form. She is female but not feminine. She is turgid with primal force, swollen with great expectations. She has no feet. Placed on end, she would topple over. Woman is immobile, weighed down by her inflated mounds of breast, belly, and buttock. Like Venus de Milo, Venus of Willendorf has no arms. They are flat flippers, scratched on the stone, unevolved, useless. She has no thumbs and therefore no tools. Unlike man, she can neither roam nor build. She is a mountain that can be climbed but can never move. Venus is a solipsist, navel-gazing. Femaleness is self-referential and self-replicating. Delphi was called the omphalos of the navel of the world. Wow. She's wild, but kind of very interesting. Very interesting. So this is, you know, this is that goddess era of which we have to be wary. There are lots of interpretations floating around, you know, about, this was the goddess period, and then then the patriarchy took over, and, we don't know. We don't really know what was when exactly. I mean, what it seems like is that there was a whole lot more cooperation during those times. That's what it was, wasn't it? One ruled over the other. I mean, we know that things have gone bad recently, but we don't know very much about back then. Although we do know about 9,000 years ago that in Turkey, that people were getting along pretty well. The goddesses and the gods were pretty well distributed, and women were making a lot of these images. You know, this could very well have been made by a woman. Very likely. Whoa, now, look at that. Fantastic. Yeah, now this is my favorite period, I confess. We're getting to be around 5,000 years ago. Now these people were directly connected in. This is Sumer, snake-headed woman, snake-headed goddess. I mean, this is the kind of thing that we're starving for. There's nothing casual here. This is it. The difficulty is when we go to a museum, if you see something like this, it's like a supermarket, you know? It's jammed in, and it's supposed to be in a temple. You're only supposed to get to see this under the right circumstances. You're supposed to be in the right state of mind. You're supposed to have prepared yourself. You don't pay $4 to get to see this. And so when we go to see it, we forget this is a holy business. And our best way back to holy business is through these images. They're the only reliable way, really, except through one's own unconscious sense. But they're the only objects that remain that are reliable. The only information. But it has to be absorbed on a different plane. Let's see. The Venus of Willendorf, that's European. Austria. Thanks. This is same area of the world, Middle East. Said to be a lion-headed deity. Extraordinary grace. Look at the connection to the animal world. Look at this. This is a feline god or goddess. And look at the delicacy holding the bird. I mean, this is full communion. It's phenomenal. Big eyes to see. This is seeing. Little things, 5.5 inches clay, the magic material, the earth, water, fire. Now, remember how they told you that Egyptians didn't understand perspective? It's in all the books. Well, I got news for them. I mean, no, a lot of people know it. I don't mean to get too proud of myself here, but it's just it's another language altogether. I mean, this is, to me, this is absolute grace. And what do you think it is? Of course, it's an offering to the god. It's Akhenaten and his family, offering to the god. Now our more direct ancestors, look at this. This was found just, I think, a couple decades ago, off the Italian coast, submerged in water. It had probably come off a ship that had gone down. Greek warrior from 400 to 450 BC by one of the great sculptors, either Phidias or his compatriot. So we get to, by some astonishing luck, we get to see the greatest bronze work of Greece. Another form of perfection. This, I think, Bill, is the perfection that we've tended to punish ourselves with as well as be inspired by. You notice how the other forms of perfection, that they don't demand quite so much of you in a certain way. They demand that you be in contact with the God, but that you don't have to be so perfect. I mean, I don't know if it's demanding that, but that's just a hit that I got. Now, one of the reasons that I've made these selections, and I wasn't certain if I was going to talk about this, but my connection with art has to do with the fact that my father was a sculptor, and I grew up in a sculpture studio and grew up in New York. And so art was our religion, art was our spiritual food. We had no church except,
radical left-wing politics, and art was everything. So my memories, my learning about art started, you know, with classes around 5 or 6, and then continuous trips to the museum. My father would stand me in front of Rembrandt and say, "Is this a masterpiece? And if so, why?" And these wonderful kind of Socratic dialogues. And so the magic of this great master just entered me, you know, and as it has, you know, millions of people. And I always love to walk up to his canvases, and when you get up there, like so many paintings, you see a few odd, casual-looking flicks of paint, little white dots here, little dark spots, and you think, wow, this isn't much. And you come back 15 feet, and my God, it's just so, you know, another towering figure of it. Painting was a high art. Leonardo said it was the highest form of technology in its time, and it was. In the Renaissance, painting represented the highest form of technology. That's another one of my favorite quotes, quoting myself, is that every age is the age of technology. It's just different. So here again is another, I hate to play the stars, only, but so this was the actual hero of my childhood, Michelangelo, because my father carved in this tradition. And this too is a work of absolute, to me, absolute perfection. This is, you know, in the Zen kind of way, this is the self of no self. I mean, this is just grace and matter. Clay model. Mary. And yet again, late in life, and all the prettiness was unnecessary. He had a hard life. He had a heck of a time. I mean, the popes drove him crazy. People didn't want to give him money. I mean, I have lots of stuff. I wish I had time to read you his letters, but here is down to the barest essentials of expression. It doesn't go beyond this. No. Another little page in my history. So this was my contact with the East. My first contact with the East was to go when I was 19 to Southeast Asia. And I actually have a journal where I write about this temple still. And this is Bante Srey. It's an outlying temple of the great complex of Angkor Wat in Cambodia. And what was this, about 1000 AD somewhere. Now, what you can't see here is that this temple is covered with tiny sculptures, some of them the size of your thumb, and each one is a masterpiece. Truly. Astonishing. Astonishing. The heights that these people reach. Good for us to remember and be reverent. The whole thing is a masterpiece. The whole thing, everything. That's what you get when you're fully in service to the God, with no doubt and no wavering, and everyone is together on it. Tremendous, proud, beautiful culture. God, they've had a horrible last century, but they're tremendous people. And this is another part of Angkor Wat. This is the gate of Angkor Thom. Yes. And some places I didn't get a slide
the trees are growing right in the temple. It's just phenomenal.
I used to rent bicycles for 10 cents a day and go to the temple. Now, Africa, which of course isn't our first visit to Africa, because the other thing that's forgotten is that Egypt is Africa too, but we like them so much we want to put them in a separate category. You know, it's like, oh no, they're not Africans. They're Egyptians. So now let me read you a little bit about Henry Moore, you know, who did the statue that's down across from the library. Here he's talking about primitive, so-called primitive sculpture, and I must say that he does qualify that he's not being pejorative, but I want to spare you that part. It might seem, from what I have said of shape and form, that I regard them as ends in themselves. Far from it. I am very much aware that associational, psychological factors play a large part in sculpture. The meaning and significance of form itself probably depends on the countless associations of man's history. For example, rounded forms convey an idea of fruitfulness, maturity, probably because the earth, woman's breast, and most fruits are rounded. And these shapes are important because they have this background in our habits of perception. The most striking quality common to all primitive art is its intense vitality. It is something made by people with a direct and immediate response to life. Sculpture and painting for them was not an activity of calculation or academism, but a channel for expressing powerful beliefs, hopes, and fears. It is art before it got smothered in trimmings and surface decorations, before inspiration had flagged into technical tricks and intellectual conceits. But apart from its own enduring value, a knowledge of it conditions a fuller and truer appreciation of later developments of the so-called great periods, and shows art to be a universal, continuous activity with no separation between past and present. Ah, now, here's Brancusi in his studio, the great Brancusi, of whom Ezra Pound said he regarded him as a saint. Yet on his levels of judgment and priority, that Brancusi was number one. Now listen to what Moore says about Brancusi. Since the Gothic, European sculpture had become overgrown with moss and weeds, all sorts of surface excrescences which completely conceal its shape. It has been Brancusi's special mission to get rid of this overgrowth and to make us more shape conscious once again. To do this, he had to concentrate on very simple direct shapes, to keep his sculpture, as it were, one cylinder, to refine and polish a single shape to a degree almost too precious. Brancusi's work, apart from its individual value, has been of historical importance in the development of contemporary sculpture. But now it may be no longer necessary to close down and restrict sculpture to the single static unit. We can begin to open out. So here's that single unit. Bird in flight. Now, listen to what Aux Enfants says about this. This is great. Constantin Brancusi is respected by true connoisseurs. His art is all fineness and love of his implacably polished materials. Imperceptible variations endow the simple surfaces of his forms with serenest life. What he does can never be popular. It demands initiation, like everything that does not talk commonplace or usual language. The American customs lately brought suit against Brancusi. They claimed that in order to avoid the duty payable on raw materials, he had made a false declaration, designated his bronzes as works of art. One of the arguments used by the customs officials was, Mr. Brancusi claims that the object represents a bird. If you met such a bird shooting, would you fire? That's the U.S. customs in the late 20s. Right on top of the arts, aren't they? So here's Kandinsky, and I show him to show the depth of the beauty of the soul
of a focused, sensitive, creative human being. I mean, it's just a wonderful example. One of the great writers on art himself as well. And it was through contact with my background was to be extremely anti-abstract. I mean, my father wanted to stay with Michelangelo and regarded these abstract artists as primarily people who were selling out, who were taking an exercise and making it into a final product. But when I stood before Kandinsky's at the Guggenheim Museum in New York, there were a couple of them, to me, the greatness just shone through. There was no question. So, I mean, it's not a good slide, but I mean, now we're entering where the world of science, the contemporary world of science, has had this profound effect on the art. You know, this whole century has been, traditional modes of art have been turned on their heads. And these deep thinkers and great artists were going through this. So I want to read just a little statement by Kandinsky about being an artist in this era. So he says, "A scientific event cleared my way of one of the greatest impediments, and that was the further division of the atom. The crumbling of the atom was to my soul like the crumbling of the whole world. Suddenly, the heaviest walls toppled. Everything became uncertain, tottering, and weak. I would not have been surprised if a stone had dissolved in the air in front of me and become invisible. Science seemed to me destroyed. Its most important basis was only a delusion, an error of the learned, who did not build their godly structures stone by stone with a steady hand in transfigured light, but groped at random in the darkness for truth and blindly mistook one object for another." As you undoubtedly know, this is Guernica. And I just got this slide this afternoon from the Seattle Art Museum. They very kindly got it to me. And this, Jean-Paul Sartre, who generally said that nobody but Goya and a couple of others could represent the horror of life and still make beautiful art, he said, yes, Picasso has done it. And he also harkens back, you see the bulls, you know, it's harkening back to that prehistory again. It's a phenomenal painting, and I was very lucky that it was in New York while I was growing up and got to spend a lot of time with it. It's an amazing painting. And now, for some reason, I can't explain exactly why, there's a poem that I wanted to read to you, and I couldn't find any rationalization for bringing it in, although it does relate to sculpture. And I couldn't figure out, and then it just hit me, oh, Guernica. So this was 1937, you know, for the Spanish Civil War. And this poem by the great Russian poetess Anna Akhmatova, this is 1940, a great, great poet who was unrecognized and even persecuted in her lifetime. And so this poem is called Epilogue 2. She's trying to visit her son who's been imprisoned for political reasons. And she's talking about all the people that she stands on line with at the prison trying to get in. "Once more, the day of remembrance draws near. I see, I hear, I feel you. The one they almost had to drag at the end, and the one who tramps her native land no more, and the one who, tossing her beautiful head, said, 'Coming here is like coming home.' I'd like to name them all by name, but the list has been confiscated and is nowhere to be found. I have woven a wide mantle for them from their meager, overheard words. I will remember them always and everywhere. I will never forget them, no matter what comes. And if they gag my exhausted mouth, through which 100 scream, then may the people remember me on the eve of my remembrance day. And if ever in this country they decide to erect a monument to me, I consent to that honor under these conditions: that it stand neither by the sea where I was born. My last tie with the sea is broken. Nor in the Tsar's garden near the cherished pine stump,
where an inconsolable shade looks for me. But here, where I stood for 300 hours, and where they never unbolted the doors for me, lest in blissful death I forget the rumblings of the Black Marias, forget how that detested door slammed shut, and an old woman howled like a wounded animal, and may the melting snow stream like tears from my motionless lids of bronze, and a prison dove coo in the distance, and the ships of the Neva sail calmly on. Okay, now, coming back to the Northwest. This is a prow piece. It would fit on the prow of a canoe. Land otter man. Very powerful, very powerful. These land otter men are mythical beings that are so powerful that there are Tlingit stories where people, you know, get into it and offend the land otter man, and they just they tell you, well, you go home and tell so-and-so this, and you'll be dead in a half an hour, and then this person will be dead in a half an hour, and then the greatest medicine man in the town takes them on, and they say, well, he'll be dead in an hour, too, and sure enough. So this is a powerful being. And this is, this needs no explanation from me. Incredible. Yes, this called the Seychelles figure, Northwest Coast also. Wilson Duff wrote a book called Images BC, and there was a show, and this book comes from that. It was published by the University of Washington Press. And he gives a brilliant exposition about this and the meaning of images. What he says is that encoded in these pieces, you know, which is both male and female and many other things at once, is a profoundly complex system of beliefs and structures which are, you know, the dualities of life, which are resolved through highly complex codes or highly special uses, which are lost to us and even the descendants of these people. But they're tremendously complex and powerful things, you know, just once again, over and over, I just say that these are the deepest, most sophisticated representations, and we mustn't be fooled by the way we've been taught to see them. They're actually far more sophisticated than we are in their ability to relate to the cosmos, far more. This is a wooden bowl that the slide I got through the courtesy of the wonderful Bill Holm, who is a retired professor here at the U and a very generous man, let me copy some slides. And to me, this is the whole question of crafts. You know, there's a big division in the art world between art and craft, and it's a very unnecessary and unfortunate division, because while they have different purposes to achieve in some instances, there is no beauty beyond this beauty either. And it, to me, there's no more boldness than that. Oh, yeah. Now, this is a wonderful illustration of the way stories connect to objects, and a very, very beautiful tale, very brief. Also Tlingit. This is a maple, piece of maple carved, and you see this figure over here with his hand in the mouth of a supernatural being, but the being is a giant rock oyster. And the story is, well, let me just read it. Many years ago, there was a Tlingit village at Kasan Bay. One day, several men went to a reef at the north end of the village at low tide to hunt devilfish. Soon, a young man located one of them under a rock. Taking his long handled hook, he poked it into the hiding place and hooked the fish. But it tore loose and moved out of reach. The man dug around the rock with a stick and finally put his hand into the crevice, although his companions cautioned him against it. As he reached under the rock, a giant rock oyster caught him by the wrist. They couldn't extricate him. Anyway, he was drowned in the tide. But as the tide reached his shoulders, he began to sing. Where is the tide? Where is the tide? Watch for thyself. Watch for thyself. O spirits of tide, they are coming up. O spirits of tide, they are coming up. O sons of tide spirit, they are coming up. The tide reached his shoulders, but the imprisoned man continued to sing. The water covered him completely, and he was dead. When the tide fell, his relatives found his body on the beach. The giant oyster had let him go. The song he composed was sung at his funeral, and since that time has been owned by his descendants. They also took the giant rock oyster as the name for their house, the communal house. So isn't this a beautiful way in which life experience is made into art and treasured and through the centuries? Just fantastic. Now this is another one of my favorite images. This is a hammer for woodworking. A brilliant hammer and very beautiful. And it has the benefit of that the hand slides along it and doesn't get jammed by the impact. So their sense of design is exquisite on every level. Also stone. Now we've gone to Japan. We're coming toward the end now. And this is one of the great influences on my life is the great culture of Japan. For me, the artistry of the Japanese is unsurpassed. There are many great cultures, but my friend Eric Nelson, the ceramic sculptor, tells a story of Morris Graves. Went to Japan as a young man and reported that when he got there, he realized immediately that these people knew how to do everything the best way. That they knew the best way to do everything, you know, and I kind of agree. So this is prehistoric, whatever that means. I mean, this is Jomon period, so it couldn't be anywhere from roughly 2 to 6,000 years old. It's a cat, obviously. And look at that presence. So these people were deep into clay and symbolism too, early on. Another jar from that period. Nobody in the world was doing this kind of a decoration at that time. It's just astonishing. This is way beyond anything for utility. This is way beyond. And you see, even today, you look at these kinds of decorations on the surface, and who are the premier makers of fabric in the world today? The Japanese. So now, Zen. What's to be said? You know, the beauty of it, the simplicity of it, the grace of it. This is the sixth patriarch. You know, these are exercises in beauty and simplicity. So this is a man of great spiritual development, great intellectual development possibly, but certainly great spiritual development. And he's at complete grace in the performance of the simplest task. It's a beautiful message. Economy. Mind of no mind. It's not for nothing that the Zen people and the Taoists tell us to go back to the before thinking mind. That's the whole message. And this is from that wonderful notion of the ox series, where the ox represents the mind that has to be tamed. And so this is close to taming the ox, but still needs the rope. Fantastic. Just fantastic. Jun, another priest, a scholar of high regard, and the figure of man. Incredible power can be transmitted in a couple of strokes.
the Japanese and the Chinese and the pictographic language people, they were already in the world of images. They didn't lose it. Mm-hmm. They didn't lose it in the same way. Tea. Edo period tea house, 18th century probably. So here you get to see the exquisite rapport with nature that the Japanese have, where irregularity is love, because the whole idea is to transcend beauty and ugliness, to transcend duality, to love the world as it is. Because in Buddhism, all problems stem from the failure to be in reality. And they bring to this search this exquisite sensibility that we see already developed thousands of years ago without stop. And this tremendous Japanese ability to focus. Incredible. Nobody accomplished this kind of... I think it was Stendhal who said that he wasn't developed enough yet to appreciate ugliness. But the Japanese, you know, streamed right by that problem. Although they have fallen, I mean, everybody today has a problem, but look at the arch at the top of that paper window. Just the beautiful bow. I mean, everything is, nothing is left to chance, but nothing is overdone. It's just wonderful. And this isn't, well, anyway, I'm not going to tell you. There are even great ones. Now, how's that for a window? Another temple, tea house. I think, I'm not sure if it's a tea house temple, but... But look at the juxtaposition of materials, the sense of line, texture, color, the mixing of the mud and the earth and the wood and the bamboo and the reeds and light. This is your mandala. Tremendous grace, tremendous grace. And this is another slide that my friend Eric is kind enough to loan me. This is a beautiful example of the sense of workmanship of the Japanese to love the process of putting the world together with exquisite skill and harmony. And this supports a roof which protects the sacred well. So here again, this is a water jug for the tea ceremony, a water jar. And it's not a great slide, unfortunately, but here again, we're wood-fired, the ash encrusting the surface. The irregularity stemming from an inner response, not a contrivance. And you see the power of it in the base. It's just, I mean, to me, I think of a great warrior, a great martial artist who, you know, can't be overturned, you know, and this great potter had that, you know, spiritual development that he could produce such a beauty. But it takes time to enter into that zone. Eric calls it a geologic palette. You know, this is the true love of earth and fire. This is another tea bowl, Shino ware. More recent. I mean, both of these are, you know, this in the 50s to the 70s, I believe. Or certainly no earlier than the 30s. So it's contemporary, actually. Now, I wanted to include something a little lighter, and I put this in just at the last minute with the Guernica slide. This is one of my favorite images. This is a little netsuke, and it's a rabbit pounding mochi, making rice cakes. And so it's actually a sacred undertaking in a certain way. And, you know, the rabbit is a symbol of fecundity and, you know, prolificness. And mochi is a very wonderful food, and it's made on, like, New Year's and festive occasions, and it's also eaten for regular food. So here he is, you know, doing his rightful task. And look at the grace of the design on his jacket.
how, you know, it's just so unselfconscious. I mean, there's perfection without the need for perfection. It's just absolute grace. Here's the studio of Noguchi, who was had loan of this studio, I think the 30s. But it shows also that sensibility. I mean, this is the great Noguchi, whose Black Sun, is it? That's in the park across from the museum. So here, this is carved out of a hillside. There's clay. I mean, there's a clay wall. And almost akin to the tea house is this beautiful juxtaposition of line. So here you have the verticals and the roughness and the textured wall behind, and you see a hint of the roof up above, which is probably latticed of different wonderful, carefully chosen woods of just, you know, when those pieces of wood might have been searched for days to have the right hue, all to give a final result of a complete nonchalance. That's their perfection. And in that little niche, you see a Haniwa figure, an ancient piece of great beauty and value. So it's a quite exquisite sensibility. And this is Noguchi's memorial in Japan that he himself designed, and it brings us right back to those ancient days, truly connected with the earth. And here's a fitting memorial for a modern master, a true master. Now I thought I'd show you a little bit of my own work with the 400 or 500 slides. So this is something I did in the 70s. It started out as a little, you see the one on top is unconnected. It just sort of came out. I was designing rings in those days and not much else but rings. And that form just came out, sort of a leaf form, and I decided to make a pendant out of one just for fun. So they're silver. And this is a pendant that I made. I made very few of these things. I made mostly rings, and this was also in that same period. And this is Mexican lace agate, which was found in a rock shop. It had been broken with a hammer, random and tumbled, but it was such a beautiful thing. It had a chunk missing out of the bottom right corner. So I lapped the wax and gold around there. And so I'm going to finish now with three or four slides of things that are most special images to me. This is the head, the remnants of the head of Queen Nai, I think the pronunciation might be. Anyway, it's Akhenaten's mother. And this fragment photo, it's in the Metropolitan. The photo always was hanging up, a little roughly cut out of a magazine or something, was always present in our household growing up. And to me, represents one of the great fragments of sculpture known, as far as I can tell. There, again, is something that, like our soul should be, is beyond harm, that its beauty is so deep and so total that nothing can harm it. It's just a very high moment of human achievement. Now we go back to not Iran, but who's our big? Who's Khomeini? Our big enemy? Who is that? What? No, Khomeini. Iran. Yeah, we're so happy to demonize these people, but look at their accomplishment. Look at the depth. Look where they were at 5,000 years ago. This is beyond words too. Bull holding a vessel made of silver. Also at the Metropolitan. Perfection. Again, we give a nod to Michelangelo,
self-portrait around the age of 80, one of the towering figures of the millennium as far as carving is gone. Looking over the Pietà, he just put himself in there. Unfinished, but it didn't need to be finished. And finally, the Miroku Bosatsu, the Buddha of the future, was waiting to come down. And we're ready, waiting patiently for 100,000 years. And this actually is the national treasure of Japan, but actually it's Korean. Many things found their way from Korea. It's a statue that I saw when I was about 20 in a busy temple in Kyoto, thronging with people, and it held me completely transfixed. Completely transfixed. It still does. To me, one of the greatest sculptures I've ever beheld. And so, oh, actually, it's not a poem. It's out of her book, Sexual Personae, Camille Paglia. The full title is Sexual Personae, Art and Decadence, from Nefertiti to Emily Dickinson, 1990. It's a big book. I just read it that way because she's a nonstop talker. And so I thought I'd, you know, bring in a little of her style. She's a quite interesting character. Yeah, so just to get this on the tape, so Chadha was making the observation that it may have been quite intentional not to have feet on the Venus because her place was to be placed directly in the ground, which is a beautiful thought. Yeah. Yeah, which period particularly? Now, okay, so Joan asked the question about what I think about the shift in art now. So what I think has happened is that when we see these great figures from the turn of the century, where people like Marcel Duchamp and the Dada movement and people like that, I mean, already it was happening, you know, the Impressionists and all these, you know, a wave of movements to reconsider as the world was changing so rapidly. Old forms of expression were being reconsidered, and the new thinking in science and physics and the growth of communications and all these changes, the build-up of history upon itself, meant that questions had to be asked. And so these deep thinkers were asking these questions, and they were working seriously and searching, and different things evolved. And then what tends to happen is that there's a dilution of thought and a dilution of education. Now, one of the problems that we've had is that in the past, among other things, a small percentage of the population was educated. And the majority of people flowed in the path of tradition. So that they say in the Song Dynasty in China, nothing ever ugly was produced because people were carried by tradition and there was a cohesiveness. So now we get a fragmentation. Our education, the people who educate us are themselves not educated, truly. You know, you can get a college degree in this country and be scarcely literate, you know. And the proliferation of images, we're totally bombarded so that we're not even conscious of what we're doing to ourselves, and it builds and it builds and it builds and it builds so that you just become overwhelmed. And so people try to express themselves and they get further and further from the ground
of experience. And then we start believing fantasies, such that if you want to be an artist, you go to art school. You come out, you're an artist. Well, what is the role of an artist? Is it to, just because Duchamp and those people made it acceptable for an idea to be sufficient for art in a certain way, that doesn't mean that we just need an outpouring of mediocre ideas, and that to have some idea makes art. There's a political side to it as well. I mean, part of it is a genuine confusion. I mean, we're all genuinely confused. And we want to be in the present. And so we denigrate history, we denigrate the past. I mean, that's, you know, that's been going on since the 9th century, arguably, and certainly Descartes is blamed for being the spokesperson for finally, I think, therefore I am. We go on the left side, but it's not, thinking is not our strongest function. I mean, otherwise none of us would come to the Jung Society, because he, you know, he better than everyone, than anyone, showed us that without this deep connection to our wellsprings, we're just, we're floating, lost. You know, the mind, the thinking mind can't be adequate, you know, so that it leads us to this problem. And there are political aspects of it too, you know, because if you have art continue to be part of the elite and it's manipulated for money, then, you know, this plays into it. I don't say it's responsible, but it plays in. And Jean Baudrillard, you know, anybody who wants to, I can recommend some interesting reading about this. Anyway, I'll stop.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.